The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's podcast, we're forecasting the future of our online interactions. Does the launch of the latest iPad signal the end of the browser? Mozilla, creators of Firefox, certainly don't think so. We hear from their European president and VP of product development about their plans for Firefox 4. Plus, we find out about the social networking service sweeping the subcontinent. MIG33, the mobile social network with 40 million registered users, is funded by the same investors as Facebook. Joining me to dig deeper into these stories are Charles Arthur, the technology editor at The Guardian, and Stuart Dredge, the latest addition to the technology pool. You are the author of The Guardian's app blog. Welcome to the team and to the pod.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Stuart, I have a question for you, right? Okay. As you represent apps for The Guardian, apps, that's just the word software rebranded, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. It's a marvelous rebranding too.
And yeah, well done, Apple, because ultimately, you know, the clue is in the name.
I think so. Apps sounds much better on TV in an advert.
Than software.
Yes. Well, for anyone who remembers operators trying to sell apps beforehand, when it was basically games and ringtones and anything else developed in the cracks, they did a marvelous job of rebranding it and making it not bottom-grindingly frustrating.
And not just that, but actually you said something quite prescient there. You said all the other things that fill in the gaps. That was certainly my experience as a PC user. And then once I went over to the Mac side, I discovered that there were a few things that needed to fill in the cracks. So ultimately what they did is they created cracks and the solution as well, didn't they?
Pretty much. I mean, I remember days when developers would say, I've got this thing that's not a game and not a ringtone, and no operator will carry it because they didn't know how to deal with it. Then Apple came along and said, hey, here's 16 categories of stuff you can do on your phone, including those things, and ran away with it.
The masters of finding the solution to problems that you didn't know you had. And Charles, so apps being a big thing, when you were out at MWC, Mobile World Congress, was there a massive app presence, or was about the hardware?
There were eight sort of halls and apps. App Planet was one entire hall, but my feeling is that that's pretty much, it's going to take over like a virus, you know, that give Mobile World Congress a couple of years and it'll be sort of seven halls of apps and one little hall of mobile operators.
App World Congress.
Absolutely, that's really the way it's going, because that's where all the money is starting to flow to. You know, the mobile operators are sort of looking around saying, can't we write some of these app things? Can't we get some of the money for it? And they're in a bad place in that respect.
Yeah, they've been leapfrogged, quite literally. Well, keep your ears tuned to Tech Weekly for these stories, plus the latest news headlines from around the web, including the scoop on the iPad 2. That's over the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. In January, open-source web browser Firefox became a more popular surfing experience in Europe than Microsoft's decade-plus dominant Internet Explorer. Now, this is great news for the Mozilla Labs, whose Firefox 4 browser has been in beta for almost a year and is set for release soon. But times have certainly changed in the web browser landscape. Back when the battle was simply between Microsoft Internet Explorer and Netscape, the business model was built for access via PCs or desktop solutions. Now, many other browsers are available, including Google's Chrome, Apple Safari, and Opera. And the market must contend with consumers who wish to surf on a huge spectrum of devices. Charles, you met with two of the top brass from Mozilla Labs recently. What did they have to say?
Well, I met with Tristan Nieto and Jay Sullivan from Mozilla, who were pushing all the benefits of Firefox 4, which they say is effectively rewritten. There's sort of nothing that remains just in base code, just because things keep on getting rewritten and looked at again from the sort of original. It's sort of as if you repaired your computer and just put every part, you'd renewed it, and yet it's still your computer because it's still the same thing. So Firefox 4, the idea really is about speed. It's about web standards, and it's about trying to deal with the web as it's going to be, with HTML5 in particular. And they said that one of the things that had driven a lot was what's happening in mobile. But one of the questions that I asked was to Jay Sullivan about how software generally, as it gets older, as it sort of gets more prominent, it just gets bigger and more things get added on. And so it stops getting faster. So I asked, how is it that they stop the code just from getting bigger and bigger?
One of the core elements of the web browser is what's called the JavaScript engine. So JavaScript is a programming language that powers the internet. And we've done a major rewrite of our JavaScript language to take code as it's running, figure out where it's slow, and make it faster on the fly. It's called just-in-time compilation. And it's a pretty technical topic. But the JavaScript engine is a big piece. The other is graphics. So as we move from a text-based web to text plus images now, plus video and other rich things, but we've really worked with our graphics engine to use what's called hardware-accelerated graphics. And most computers today, and increasingly mobile phones, in addition to the CPU, the main chip that runs your device, also has what's called a GPU, a graphics processing unit. And Firefox 4 takes advantage of that. So what's going to happen is your browser is going to start up faster. It's going to load pages faster. When you switch among tabs, it's going to be snappy. So there's always more you can do. And in terms of your other question about, well, don't you just accumulate code? Well, actually what happens over time is you're constantly doing what's called refactoring of your code. So you look at how it's running, but you run tests to do what's called profiling to see what's happening, why is it taking time to run, and you rewrite it. And just like the skin on a human body is constantly being recycled, the code that makes up a large product like Mozilla is constantly recycled over time. So we've rewritten almost the whole thing in place over the last several years. So it has been around for a while, but through this rewriting, it gets leaner and meaner over time. And one of the focusing elements that really helped us do that was porting Firefox to the mobile phone. So we're spoiled by our computers and how fast they can run. But when you go to bring a browser as rich as this to a mobile phone, you feel the pain fast, so you optimize fast.
Is there any do you feel having that you have Microsoft coming behind you, that you have Google Chrome perhaps running beside or ahead of you, that you have Apple Safari, all these competitors? Does that give you some drive as well?
So you have to remember, we were founded to bring choice and competition to the web. So when Mozilla Firefox started, Internet Explorer had about 97% market share. The web was stagnating. HTML wasn't moving forward, and people weren't in a position where they could create richer and richer, more beautiful, powerful applications. So we exist to provide that competition. Now we live in that world that we created. So one, we like to compete. So we're not afraid of these big guys. So we have Google, Microsoft, companies with massive resources. And we're a small, scrappy organization. We only have about 300 people in the company, and we have thousands of contributors in the open source community, and we're happy to compete on that. But at the end of the day, it's about the user. All we focus on is how can we make their life on the web better. Competition's fine, and we enjoy it, but we always have to come back to what we can do to make users' lives better on the internet.
You're one of the most famous open source projects, but you do actually have dedicated programmers, don't you, working on Firefox?
We do.
So it's not a sort of a free and easy sort of thing. It's actually much more directed than that. Does that make Firefox atypical despite its fame?
I don't think so. I think every open source project has a scheme by which you can take those resources and direct them in the right way. So, the Linux kernel had a certain approach in the way they would manage each section of code. We have an approach. It's called modules, and each module has a module owner. So although we have hundreds of people who are writing code for the project, it's still a meritocracy, and you have to earn your stripes, and you have to, for each change you want to make to the browser, you have to explain it clearly to those people who have earned respect in the project over time to be able to make those changes. So it's chaos and order kind of working together to make the browser better.
You mentioned that the Firefox 4 includes support for the video tag, which has been a slightly contentious issue because Google has said that it's going to drop support for H.264 in Chrome. I think the Firefox doesn't supply that already. Do you have a sort of a strong feeling about VP8 and H.264, where those are going?
Yes, we believe that WebM and VP8 are the way forward for the web. We want a codec that is unencumbered on all sides, meaning if you're going to encode video, if you're going to provide transport for video, if you're going to, as a browser, receive and decode video. We believe that just like images and text on the web, video should be a first-class citizen. And we think open codecs like VP8 are the way forward.
Do you think that VP8 and WebM will turn out to be unencumbered? Because there is MPEG-LA, which looks after H.264, seems to be looking around for any possible patent infringement.
I think you said it right. They are looking around for any possible patent infringement. I think they're creating a fair amount of, or attempting to create some fear, uncertainty, and doubt around it because they're trying to protect their own interests, which is H.264.
What if they do find a patent infringement in WebM and has to lie under that? What then do you think will you do in Firefox?
Yeah, I mean, I'm confident that it'll withstand the scrutiny there and that we will stick with it going forward.
Okay. Tristan, in Europe, Mozilla is it's a foundation which takes money. Are you still getting paid by Google for the search bar where you have search input which goes via Google?
We do have several partnerships with search engines, and Google is the leading one in this case, yes.
What sort of money does that bring in? Because many people might not be aware of the fact that when they do a search in the search bar, that a little bit of money goes from Google to the Firefox group.
More precisely, they have to do a search in a search bar and then click on ads, and so that's the way it is. But they can remove Google from a search bar and use an alternative search engine, whether it's listed in Firefox or another one. We do not really care. You know, we're a nonprofit organization. We're mission oriented. Our goal is to improve the web. So we need to be sustainable because we do have employees. But really making a lot of money is not our goal. So as soon as we have enough money to be sustainable, we're happy. We're not into maximizing profit. I know it may sound a little strange in this world, or at least unusual, but that's the way it is.
How significant is that sort of income to Mozilla's?
It's roughly we make $100 million a year
from Google click throughs,
from various partnerships, including Google.
Uh-huh. And what sort of budget does Mozilla Foundation have in overall? Do you know?
I don't have the number from the top of my head, okay. But it's we spend less than we make. We save a little money for the rainy days.
Okay, and in Europe, I mean, the use of the Firefox browser is very heavy in Germany, for example. Yes. Is Europe a better place for Firefox than the US?
It is true that Firefox adoption is particularly strong in Europe and even more in Eastern Europe because, like, for example, as you said, Germany is roughly 50%, Poland is roughly 50% market share, and also other countries in Eastern Europe where it looks like they didn't have much the memory muscle, you know, to switch, to click on the blue E. And so when Firefox came, they were happy to adopt it. So adoption has been better in Eastern Europe. But roughly, overall in Europe, we're at 33% market share, which is better than the US, which is roughly 25 to 30%.
That was Charles Arthur speaking with Tristan Nito, president of Mozilla Europe, and Jay Sullivan, vice president of product for Mozilla Europe. So Charles, Firefox beating Internet Explorer is a bit of a coup in Europe for the company.
You don't get to the level where it is of being above Internet Explorer without actually having some enterprise penetration. So there are big organizations which are using it because they can see benefits from it, that it's more secure, for example, than Internet Explorer. It's not being attacked in the same way. And there are still plenty of add-ons that can be written for it. So it has that sort of enterprise penetration.
Stuart, a lot of people are saying that the browser is going to go the way of the dodo because, you know, we're going to be accessing our web content via apps. What do you think that browsing companies, people who develop browsers, need to do to future-proof themselves for their own demise, you know, to make sure that they are still relevant on handheld applications?
I think there's still a lot of demand for a browser on a mobile device. I mean, if you go to an app store, you're probably searching for a thing, a person, or a game. But if you're looking for a subject or a topic or a news story, you will go to the browser every time and look at it. So there's a lot of focus being put on getting their browsers onto mobile devices to provide an alternative to apps, and that seems to be quite a fertile field.
Even when you have apps, if you're often doing some sort of browsing through them, so you come down to what actually is the basic browser built into the handheld, or what is the browser that you've managed to make the default on your handheld, if you're able to do that. So I think that what happens is that you start to find that for the browser companies to survive and to thrive, certainly they have the enterprise penetration, if you've got an enterprise which has got desktops, which has also got people using tablets of some sort, which has also got people using smartphones of some sort, they have to focus on developing for and using browsers that are as standard as can be. So you've got to have, for a browser company, you've got to be really, really standard. You've got to pass all the HTML5 tests, the CSS3 tests, the ACID3 test. You've got to be as conformant as you can possibly be, because then you're not going to look different on the smartphone or on the tablet or on the desktop.
And I suppose that's what Firefox and what Mozilla is trying to do ultimately with what they are doing with Firefox.
That's a really big part of it, because in essence you now have only three, perhaps four competing browsers. You've got Opera, which is widely deployed, let's say not necessarily used, on Nokia phones, I think. You have WebKit, which is the Android browser, which is also the Safari browser. You have Gecko, which is the Firefox browser, and you have Trident, which is the Internet Explorer browser. And those are basically the ones which are fighting it out. The fact that you've got Android plus the iPhone means that the mobile space is all in WebKit, really. And Firefox has something of a challenge there, I've got to say. But they're doing well on the desktop.
Do you think, though, that this is going to turn into this kind of epic battle, as we saw between Netscape, who was Firefox's predecessor, and Internet Explorer, given the bundling aspect of a browser onto a handheld piece of technology?
Well, I think the danger for browser companies trying to target mobile is you're constantly plugging holes or building on top of what's not in the native browser. So iPhone's a good example. Two browsers have been very popular, Skyfire and Opera Mini. Opera Mini because it does compressing of pages and it costs less data, and Skyfire can do Flash, or it converts Flash movies on the fly. But as soon as Apple, if and when, decides to implement those features, you're left without a big USP. And so if you're a browser company, you're constantly trying to do what the native browsers aren't, but then you're constantly catching up with yourself if they put those features in.
What are the native browsers doing or not doing?
Well, on iOS, the big thing is obviously Flash. So Skyfire, which released a paid browser actually for iOS, and made a couple of $1 million of revenue, I think, from charging for a browser purely because it could use Flash content. And that was from a very early adopter audience, I think, and not a big mainstream play. So is that, I mean, other browsers have put social features in. So Firefox, I believe, on mobile is making social part of that with Social Bar. And again, that's something where you would expect that to come in over time to the native browsers. So then you wonder where the improvement is for the third-party stuff.
But you get a real fight then, between, because you get the browser companies which say, well, we want to have something which gives us a USP, so we'll build in social, or we'll build in this, or we'll build in that, which actually leads to security holes, which means the enterprises say, uh-oh, we're not going to have that because it's got this big hole in it which could be exploited. And so they're driven down two conflicting routes, which are sort of incompatible, which is they have to be able to do everything just like every other browser so that it doesn't look different between your desktop and your tablet, and yet they want to be different so that you'll choose this one over that one. And you know, there isn't a simple answer. There's no way that actually you can square that circle. You simply have to see how it plays out.
Well, you can have a go on Firefox in beta now, Firefox 4 in beta now at mozilla.com. And the mobile version is also now in beta in the Android marketplace. Here's this week's news with Jemima Kish.
Apple has launched the second incarnation of the iPad, featuring front and rear cameras, a lighter, slimmer body, and a dual-core A5 processor. More surprising was an appearance by Steve Jobs to introduce the new tablet, despite being on medical leave. Spotify has reached 1 million paying subscribers, with founder Daniel Ek announcing that 15% of users now pay for what is the largest streaming music service in the world. Spotify is also partway through a $100 million funding round that values it at $1 billion. Twitter caused a storm in a tweak-up over the weekend by introducing a scroll bar of trending topics to its iPhone app. Quickly christened the Dick Bar, users objected when the space was also used for invasive promoted tweets, but Twitter's chief executive Dick Costolo has insisted the Dick Bar is here to stay. Google has bought UK price comparison site BeatThatQuote.com for £37.7 million, setting out the search engine strategy of exploiting the price comparison industry by integrating with its own services. Google also ties in the founder, John Paliomalites, who used to run internet security firm JCP.
Thanks, Jemima. Now, next week, you and I are going to be at the annual South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas.
Yeehaw!
Yeehaw, indeed. Covering the event for the podcast. What are you looking forward to? What's on your radar for a South by?
Well, I don't want to sound like we're South by Southwest obsessives. The reason that it's really good is just the concentration of people that go. So I suppose being ruthlessly journalistic, you know, it's a very efficient way to meet a lot of people and get a lot of ideas in a relatively short amount of time. So that's why I get so excited about it.
But South by, over the past few years, has grown enormously. When I first went, I think there was something like, I don't know, 3,000 to 5,000 people. Now, apparently there are 15,000 people who are attending this year.
Just for Interactive.
Yes.
It's 36,000 overall, I believe.
How do you parse that? Because again, it used to be like, you know, you had an option of 5 different streams of content that was happening at any one time in one space. But now apparently there's something like 25 different streams happening at any point in any location throughout the entire city. What are you going to go to? How are you going to decide?
I've made a long list. I've trawled through the schedule at great personal cost to my eyes, may I add. And I've come up with a big list of stuff I'm interested in. But I think what is really interesting is that there is a diversity of stuff, but they haven't particularly diversified this year. They have added an international element with this tech summit, which has got experts from about 20 different countries coming, which is really interesting. But if you look at the main Interactive Festival and the stuff that is on, what you have is the opportunity to go into subjects in real depth, which is something you often don't get at other conferences where you have too many people on the panels and the sessions are too short, and there just isn't enough time to give into exploring specific things. So I won't go into the conference session titles now, but they are very, very specific and very well selected.
Are there any particular trends? Is there a movement towards social media, for example? I've heard some people on the street saying that, you know, there's a lot of marketers who are going to be going this year to South by.
And there's also a session called How to Avoid Marketeer Douchebaggery at South by Southwest.
I mean, I've selected that one to watch.
You name something that is a current trend or a growing trend or something that's particularly hot or something that's just beginning to gather interest, it will be discussed at South by Southwest. And we do want to cover the things that listeners are interested in if you can't go. So take a look at the schedule online at sxsw.com. Look at the schedule and tell us what you'd like to be covered, because we've got a big team going.
Yeah,
there's
a whole bunch of Guardian
Loads
and Guardian-friendly people who are going to be going out, aren't
there? It's a great thing for The Guardian. I mean, it's music, film, technology, and we already have a very big US audience. It's already a third of our traffic, so it's massive, you know, for us.
And how are we going to be covering it? Because we're going to be covering it for people on the ground, and we're also going to be covering it for people back at home?
The coverage is split into two areas this year. We've got the Google-sponsored project where they've paid for a team of 6, that's 3 journalists and 3 developers, to go out and do kind of more lightweight, experimental, hacky coverage. And then we've got a more traditional reporting team who will be doing coverage for Guardian.co.uk, and there'll be coverage in our print papers as well. So Guardian.co.uk/South by Southwest.
Brilliant. Well, we will have an entire program on South by Southwest next Tuesday, where we'll be reporting from Texas, y'all.
Yeehaw!
The mobile application MIG33 is the subcontinent's largest social networking service, connecting over 40 million unique users in the mobile-first countries like Indonesia, India, South Africa, the Middle East, and Bangladesh. But unlike the enormously popular mobile social networks in other regions like Singapore, Korea, and Japan, where on-the-go networking is also extremely popular, MIG33 connects people via voice as anonymous users. This, according to Mohit Gundicha, the head of operations for the company, is the secret of MIG33's success. Now, I met with him at the India Social Summit in Delhi and began by asking him to describe MIG33 to me in his own words.
You know, this place, you know, realities of life, especially in these markets, don't let people be what they want to be. Urban areas, you know, you and I, or, you know, in Mumbai's and Delhi's of the world, where Facebook and Twitter are more popular, there I have enough opportunities to go out. But in smaller towns where we don't have as many social entertainment options, and they may not be as outgoing to go and post their real life there, they still want to enjoy the thrill of social networking. But that's why they adopt virtual identities and be what they want to be.
Tell me how they access. Tell me a little bit about the nuts and the bolts of MiG-33.
So they access it via their mobile phone. Many of them don't have access to PCs. They have access to mobile. It's an application, Java application we call. People download it one time. Most of the people here have internet-enabled phones now. The internet penetration on mobile is growing, and that's how they access that works.
Is this on smartphones or is this on pre-smartphones?
No, this is, we call that a feature phone category. So many of these guys don't have, you know, the iPhones of the world. In countries like India and Indonesia, iPhones is not as popular.
And what is the saturation of mobile in India?
Oh, I mean, today, you know, more than half of India has cell phones, like 600 million people have cell phones. Of course, out of that, hardly 3% today have mobile internet connections. But in the past 3 to 6 months, we have seen a huge increase because of cheaper data plans. So mobile internet cost is sub $2 now in India. Unlimited mobile internet plans for less than $2. Plus, the handset profiles, handset getting better. So this is a very good time, and we hope the trend continues.
How do you see the trend continuing globally? At the moment, you work in particular regions. Sure. Do you hope ultimately to break the UK, to break the US?
Not really. Those are more of, you know, developed markets where iPhone has taken over. You know, the iPhone economy is US, UK. Japan, Korea already have local. You know, these are way ahead of other wireless markets, Japan and Korea. QQ, Tencent has taken over China. It's the most popular social network there. Japan and Korea are taken by Mobagetown and Gree. These are their local social network. But there's no dominant mobile social network in countries like India, Indonesia, South Africa, Middle East. And there is where, you know, MiG-33 plays in.
How long do you feel before the feature phones are phased out, before smartphones begin to dominate the market?
So Android seems to be taking off. We already have released an Android app to make sure that we are not behind the wave. It will take some time, couple of years, a year at least, where you will see a significant, at least in India I'm speaking about. Android is starting, they're starting to bring the Android phones around $120, $130, and we will continue to see. But, you know, with handsets, you know, not over time, overnight, the profile doesn't change. You know, the handset profile changes in few quarters. So hopefully by end of next year, we'll see more smartphones in India.
And what do you see as the future of mobile networking globally?
Yeah. The future is social games, virtual goods, the virtual economy. So, you know, Facebook has 500 million users, roughly $1.5 billion revenue. You know, the social networking companies like Mobagetown or Gree in Japan, 20 million users but $500 million in revenue. So, you know, future is, you know, the virtual economy, social games is what this will evolve towards.
And what will you do to support that?
Yeah, I mean, we have both of those. Virtual economy is what we want to be, the QQ of the rest of the world. You know, we've grown to an extent, want to grow from here.
That was Mohit Kundecha from MiG-33, India's largest mobile social network. Now, Charles, countries like India and, you know, the continent of Africa, they've got enormous, I mean, phenomenal mobile markets that would boggle our minds. Did any countries in Africa or did India, did they have presences at Mobile World Congress? Were there any significant sort of, that's the Africa section or that's
well,
the
no, it
section.
Doesn't really work that way because what tends to happen at Mobile World Congress is that people are touting their wares and representatives from the mobile networks in those countries will come along and say, okay, you know, show me what you've got. So there were certainly representatives from all these, you know, different countries. I saw a lot of people from, you know, various African nations around, and certainly from the subcontinent and so on, and they're all looking at what's going to go on. It's certainly interesting to reflect that these are markets where Android is just starting to get going, where low-cost Android phones are going to make an enormous difference to the entire way actually that people's lives work. You know, there's just a vast potential market there for developers, I think, in those spaces. But actually, they've got very effective markets going already with feature phones, mobile payments through M-Pesa and so on. It's the sort of thing that we don't see in all the arguments that we get about, well, my smartphone's better than your smartphone. Mm-hmm. It's just a sort of little pimple on compared to the sort of money that's flowing around through text message payments in places like Africa.
Is there any actual interest, though, from the West, from the US, from Europe, from Australia, looking at these regions, looking at these territories, and saying that's an interesting thing that we could potentially integrate into our own mobile market?
It's really strange how mobile banking and stuff like that just has not transferred back out of subcontinent, back out of Africa towards, say, the UK. And I suspect it's partly to do with what people expect out of their mobiles. It's partly to do with what the banks will or won't allow. But it simply, those ideas just don't, you don't re-import for some reason from old things onto the new things. You just don't see that. So no, it's just not being taken up.
It's a fascinating notion, this sort of cultural identification with a gadget. But Stuart, when we think about social networks and we think about accessing social networks in the UK, we think about using non-mobile native. You know, we think about the Facebook app, or we think about the Twitter app, or whatever it is that you use. Do you see a time, though? Do you see a trend where there will be mobile native social networks that will emerge over here?
I think you're definitely seeing mobile social apps. I mean, Foursquare would be the biggest example of something that had publicity. But I think the key thing in the West is they're going to get built on top of Facebook's social graph. So if you're trying to do something social and mobile, you probably need to build on top of Facebook to even sign up their friends. But I think it's more like to be niches over here. So a good example of a British company is Flirtomatic, which is based around flirting and romance. And they've built that on mobile for years ago on feature phones using texts rather than apps, and they've now got an app. And you're now seeing that extend into social location flirting and dating apps. So you're sitting having a coffee and you get a little ping saying someone's nearby who might match you. Do you want to have a chat to them and then meet up perhaps? So
it's all in the words in theory, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, I would actually like to see that kind of thing. I'd like to see that kind of thing at a library, a research library, like the British Library, not with any intention of what might happen, but in terms of things like collaboration. You know, say you walk into the library and you say, I'm interested in social psychology networks and the internet, and then if somebody else matches your topic interest, then it tells you and you think, right, okay, time for coffee, I want to go come up with new and interesting research questions.
Oh, it sounds like Microsoft Clippy. Hey, I see you're writing about social psychology.
Yeah, well, things like LinkedIn as well. I mean, anything that involves you're in an airport and someone near you who's in your line of work. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that can be done, but I think it builds upon those web-based social networks like LinkedIn and Facebook rather than trying to create one from scratch, which is a different state of affairs to kind of a place like India where the mobile is the first device people are having.
That relationship that Charles was talking about, though, Stuart, you know, the sort of cultural identification with your apps, with your, you know, your app market. Is there anything that you would say is particularly British? You know, what are some of the sort of British consumption patterns of apps that are different from the rest of the world?
Last year, I think it was a Comscore presentation at a conference that was saying the most popular iPhone apps ever in I think it was US, Europe, and UK. And the US top one was Pandora Music. In the Europe, it was Facebook. And in the UK, it was iPint, the poorer pint, which kind of, I was half proud and half disgusted.
Is it because it's free?
Oh, God,
it's
all
free.
Of the above. Let's
it's free. It lets you show
stereotypes.
Off and it's got beer in it. But I don't know. I mean, nowadays, you don't really care where an app comes from. So there's less a sense of going out and finding British apps. But I think there's probably trends. I mean, anything that lets us get beyond our normal reserve is probably quite popular as well, hence the flirting apps.
Well, you can find out more at guardian.co.uk/technology for more. And Stuart, what's the URL for the apps blog?
I've learned it now. guardian.co.uk/technology/apps blog.
Well, that's it for this week's Tech Weekly. We're in Austin, Texas, in the next installment, bringing you the headlines and the stories from South by Southwest. But before we go, I wanted to do a quick round robin here, given that we were talking about extensions and add-ons earlier when we were talking about the Firefox interview. Charles, what's your favorite extension for Firefox?
It'd be a tie between Firebug, which lets you inspect the way that a page is made up, and HTTPS Everywhere, which means that you don't log in insecurely.
Ooh, I like the sound
like
of that.
Facebook and things.
Yeah, because I, you know, occasionally you just get so astounded by the fact that you find yourself halfway through typing in some private details and then you look up at the address bar and you go, oh, that's not secure. So that's, I'll look that one up. What about you, Stuart?
Mine's very boring. It's a thing called Pixlr, which is an online Photoshop type service, and it looks interesting. It lets you right click on any image and start editing it. So for blogging and swiping images from all over the place.
You wouldn't swipe them, of course.
No, swiping copyrights.
Creative Commons. And
but I used to have a music one, which let you go to any music blog, and it would sort of pull out the music that was embedded on that blog and put it in a little playlist at the bottom, which was very exciting, but I think it didn't do that well, and now it's kind of defunct.
There's quite a big library of defunct, no longer updated extensions, isn't there?
And Firefox 4 is going to make it even more interesting.
Well, thank you very much to our studio guests, Stuart Dredge and Charles Arthur. The producer this week was Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Kratosky. See you in Texas, y'all.
Yeehaw!
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.